You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 76 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Before we get to anything, well, let's get to our beer first so we can have a toast.
All right, let's do that. We have with us here the Anderson Valley Fall Hornin Pumpkin Ale. Ale brewed with pumpkin and spices. And let's see, I'm going to have to go to the website because they do not have this information on the beer can. With a brilliant deep copper hue and creamy beige-colored head, our Fall Hornin Pumpkin Ale has inviting aromas of caramelized malt and baking bread with highlights of cinnamon, nutmeg, pumpkin, and seasonal spices. The pleasantly creamy mouthfeel and silky body embrace the sweet caramel flavors and tang of spices with just hint of hops that ends in a smooth, round finish. And they suggest is food pairings.
I was going to say, I want to note the food pairings.
Yeah. Cranberry scones.
Not just regular scones.
Roasted root vegetables, steak chili, and caramel flan.
If you're having regular chili, that's not okay.
Also, cheese pairings, brie and aged cheddar. Now, sadly, we have neither brie nor aged cheddar.
We just have regular cheddar. It hasn't been aged. You know, it's getting to be that time of year.
It is.
We're drinking pumpkin beer. We're doing it.
We've moved out of fresh hop season and into fall seasonal pumpkin season.
So what are we toasting to here?
Well, we're toasting, I think, to, I would say, a successful first edition of Seattle Sports Trivia hosted by the Peltoncast this evening at the Runaway.
Thank you so much to, and we're toasting to you, all of the third Pelton brothers who came out tonight.
All of the listener.
We met Aaron R., Aaron S.
So many different Aarons.
The SSS BDA crew, Nate, Tyler, and Lexi.
Who emerged victorious. And Nate and I went head-to-head in trying to name as many Mariners outfielders as we could. And it seemed, when you first said that as the category, I was like, oh, that's way too broad. We're going to keep going for hours. And then it got so hard to name Mariners outfielders. And after I said Eric Anthony,
naming infielders who were converted to outfield. Like Rich Amaral, I'm a little bit skeptical about Rich Amaral and Mark McElmark.
I mean, this, by the way, is part of the problem with Mariners outfielders as a category. Like, does anyone, like Jeff Nelson played a game in left field once.
Oh, that wouldn't count.
I should have named him, but again,
Mark McElmark, did they convert him to outfield permanently?
Yeah, he played left field in 2001. He started the vast majority of his games in left field. I don't think
Nate, for winning Seattle Sports Trivia, the Nate, Tyler, Lexi team, unfortunately, Nate lost to you in his Seattle Mariner outfielder off. Somehow you knew more about baseball than somebody. But then also the famous cousin Katie, Natalie, and Josh, and you know, all of the new third Pelton brothers who we met tonight. Thank you so much for coming out. It was great. You know, I think we're going to look at trying to do this again at some point in the future. You're just looking up Mark McElmark.
A special shout out to Curtis Rogers, who competed by himself against these teams of up to five people and still finished tied for first
place.
Was
wearing an Arizona shirt and answered numerous questions about the University of Washington.
He sure did. That group told me that they taunted him when the Isaiah Thomas question came up.
Okay, good. I would expect nothing less.
I'm going to try to post these somewhere. I don't think Sporkle's a good place, but I'm going to try and find somewhere that I can post these questions so everyone can take the quiz.
Why is Sporkle not a good place?
Well, just because of the fact that, like, you know, if you answer...
You're so over Sporkle.
No, because it's not a list of things, it's specific questions.
Okay.
So if you put in, you know, like there were many colleges. So if you put in school X, you might get a different question than you were trying to answer.
I
don't want that to happen.
Okay.
That is the last thing I want to happen.
You should figure that out quickly.
I will try to.
Well, anyway, thank you again to everybody who came out. It was excellent. We'll try to do Seattle Sports Trivia again at some point in the future. If you own or run a sports bar and are interested in hosting us at Seattle Sports Trivia, let us know, because that might be something that we'd be interested in doing.
Mark McElmore in 2001 played 68 games in the outfield.
All right.
71 games.
Fine.
Or 80 games in the infield.
Rich Amaral is converted to an outfielder also?
For sure.
Okay.
He barely played the infield at all after he had all those errors in 94. We'll get into that. That's a different pod.
Just a Rich Amaral pod.
The other thing I wanted to make sure to mention is if you haven't listened to our podcast with Rich Cho talking about his website, BigTimeBites.com in Seattle and Portland food, be sure to give that one a listen. That one will stay nice and fresh, not really time sensitive.
Pun intended.
Yes.
So while we were hosting Seattle Sports Trivia at the Numos Complex, assuming you weren't at that, you obviously were at
City Hall.
Seattle City Hall for the meeting to discuss.
So an open hearing for the Seattle City Council to get feedback from local citizens, and in this case, probably more specifically fans, about the two arena proposals in front of them. And this was, I would say, a bigger day for the Soto Arena group than it was for the group bidding, Oakview group bidding to renovate Key Arena. Chris Hansen, the lead investor, the face of that project, made the trip up to Seattle from the Bay Area, did a round of media, and the big takeaway from that media blitz was that they are open to there being two arenas in the city of Seattle. So that
the Hansen group is open to it.
Yes. And the MOU with the Oakview group does not preclude that from happening. So their vision would be that, you know, the NHL would presumably go to a renovated Key Arena along with the concerts that Live Nation would bring there. And then the Soto Arena would be primarily used for NBA basketball. And I think, you know, that does certainly address some of the concerns in terms of, you know, the transportation impacts on the port. If you're only having half as many games there.
Yes.
And maybe even less than that, you know, if the Storm stay at a renovated Key Arena as opposed to moving to Soto, Seattle U, like it's a substantially lower number of events that you'd be having at Soto Arena than if you had all these teams there. So it answers some of the concerns from a transportation standpoint. And, you know, really all along, the focus for the Hansen Group, as we've said on this podcast, it's on basketball and bringing the NBA back, bringing the Sonics more specifically, back to Seattle, whereas that is not the overriding modus operandi for the Oakview group. They're in this for the financial benefit.
So how realistic does this seem? Because when you're saying this to me, it feels like, I mean, we've had a lot of things that seem very obvious, but...
Welcome to politics in 2017.
It seems like to me, the group that is looking to renovate the Oakview group, who are looking to renovate Key Arena, are very interested in hockey and are very interested in concerts.
Yes.
And don't have room for basketball.
I mean, they have maintained that they see basketball as part of this and that, you know, just they can't count on basketball because of the difficulty obtaining an NBA team, which, you know, would be true for the Soto Arena group anyways. And of course, the, you know, the point that the Soto group will make is that if you grant the street vacation request, that they will not build until they secure a team. There's no downside to that from the city's perspective. Do I think that's going to happen? I don't think it's going to happen concurrently with the Key Arena proposal. And there was a report today from Jeff Baker of the Seattle Times that the Seattle Department of Transportation said, I believe that they're still 5 to 6 months away from being able to forward that street vacation request to city council. So, you know, we're talking about next spring at that point, and by the time they actually would vote on it next summer. So the Key Arena part of the equation will probably be settled by then. Would they consider approving Soto Arena on top of that? I don't know. I mean, I really don't have a good feel for it because, you know, all along they've really discussed it as an either or proposition. So,
but when you think about all of the different questions that arise, right? You're talking about filling every single sport that we'd like to have in Seattle, plus concerts, plus an answer to the port, no matter who knows how pleased they'll be with this answer.
I'm sure they would still maintain that any new arena in Soto, even if it's, you know, less busy, would still be disruptive to their business.
Less traffic, though, overall, because there are less games happening in the Soto area. 40 less games, a significant amount, plus the amount of concerts that would be going to a renovated Key Arena.
And like I said, the Storm in Seattle, you would presumably stay at Key Arena or play elsewhere. So,
and so if the Chris Hansen group is okay with this, right? Because right now, the being willing to move forward is on them. At that point, in that regard,
if they get the street vacation,
who is against this aside from the port?
I mean, I'm sure the Oakview group will be against it. I don't think they're excited about having a competing arena within the same city. So, you know, I'm sure that there will be objection from them. I mean, beyond that, you know, we'll see. We'll see. I guess I don't know.
Okay, and do we have any sense of what came out of this meeting today?
So based on reading the reports, obviously we weren't able to be there because of the trivia that we were hosting. It sounded like Sonics fans outnumbered NHL fans at this meeting, which was different from, as we talked about, the last city council meeting, which took place during the day, not after work hours as this one did. It really has become clear that there is a divide between the NBA and NHL community at this point, with the NHL community preferring the Key Arena solution because of the fact that, you know, I think they recognize that either option brings the NHL to Seattle, and Key Arena does so, you know, more quickly because there's an ownership group in place. There's a clear path to an NHL team. So that's kind of the battle line, I would say, that has been drawn at this point. But, you know, certainly a stronger statement on behalf of Soto Arena than we've seen in the past at these council meetings.
Well, that's good to hear, at the very least.
The other bit of news here on this topic, I think, is the candidates for the two open council positions and then the mayor's office were asked about the arena's discussion at the League of Women Voters event held last Thursday. I think the most important, most interesting responses on this topic. Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez, who is the heavy favorite, I would say, to retain her position, said that I do believe the Key Arena proposal that is working its way through the city council right now is an important one. Seattle Center is a city asset. It's an important one for us to make sure we are taking care of and continue to invest in. The Soto Arena deal is not ready for us to consider yet. I think that I expressed some concerns about that particular proposal in May of 2016 when, to editorialize, she voted against the street vacation. I'm waiting to see if those issues have been addressed, particularly around transportation impact and some public benefit issues. I'm excited about seeing a potential package from our SDOT and Design Review Commission that addresses the issues that many of us, five of us, again, those who voted no, on the City Council expressed back in May. John Grant, who I would say is probably the favorite for the other open council position, that one being vacated by Tim Burgess as he retires after spending time as the interim, as the mayor, continued to maintain his pro-Key Arena position. He has been staunchly against the Soto Arena because of his alliance with the Port of Seattle.
Right.
And then among the mayoral candidates, you know, both, as we talked about last week, it didn't really take a strong stand either way, but Carrie Moon again doubled down on her concerns about Live Nation's involvement with the Oakview Group and the Key Arena renovation, saying, "Live Nation can really do harm to the local music industry, so I want to make sure we get the deal right with Live Nation, but I would like to support making Key Arena work because we need to protect industrial land and we have to preserve that for family wage jobs." So,
okay. Basically, no proposal at this point includes just doing nothing with Key Arena, though.
I mean, that's not really a viable long-term option, no.
Yes.
So if for some reason the Key Arena MOU was voted down, then I think you would see more discussion of the Soto Arena Group's plan to renovate it into smaller music venues at that point.
Interesting. Anything else on arena-related stuff?
I think that's it for now, but, you know, stay tuned. This will continue to heat up. We're inside 2 months away from the potential vote on this on December 4th. I don't know if we'll actually, you know, get a vote on that schedule, but again, that's the hope of the mayor's office and the Office of Economic Development.
And what about soccer? Should we talk USMNT before we talk Sounders?
Let me do a Tristan Sider.
You can't do it. You're just not enough sire.
Can you do it? So also, while we were doing trivia, the USMNT was facing Trinidad and Tobago in the final game of CONCACAF qualifying for the 2018 World Cup. And all the USMNT needed was a draw after winning handily last week at home, after getting a needed Costa Rica draw against Honduras over the weekend. Everything set up nicely until they gave up two goals to tiny Trinidad and Tobago, is long out of hope for the World Cup. In the first half, went down 2-0, pulled back one goal in the second half from Christian Pulisic, the bright spot in a dark, dark day for the USMNT. And meanwhile, results elsewhere went poorly for them. Honduras came back from a halftime deficit to beat Mexico, and Panama, with a late goal in what would have been a draw with Costa Rica, that pushed the U.S. off of the fourth spot, where they would have at least had a chance to qualify via the Intercontinental Playoff, and entirely out of the World Cup.
So this is it. They're done.
They're done for the first time since 1986.
Oh, my God.
This is bad. This is disastrously bad. I don't know what else to tell you.
And we keep talking about when the moment is going to be that the U.S. starts dominating at soccer globally.
Friday night, it felt a lot closer than it
four,
did.
Four more years. Today. We have to wait 4 more years. I mean, unbelievable. I think there's going to have to be a lot of U.S. soccer fans who are going to be looking around the world trying to find who they should be cheering for.
And we still may be doing this because our number two team is Italy, and they are not assured a spot in the World Cup themselves.
I've got a team for you. My team.
Who is that?
Finland.
Finland.
It's all about Finland.
Okay. I'm think I'm going Costa Rica.
I'm okay with that also.
Vamos, chicos.
But I'm in on Finland early. You remember that when they win the 2018 World Cup?
Wow. You heard it here first and only. So yeah, that was bad. Yeah, everything about it was bad. I guess here's the bright spot. I'm going to look for the silver lining. And being a generally optimistic sort, the good news is if Clint Dempsey is still on the Sounders in next season, he will still be with the team during the Olympic break or the World Cup break.
There we go.
Huge advantage.
That's who we should have been celebrating tonight.
Yeah. Although Ramon Torres now, they have to go through the Intercontinental Playoff, but there's a chance he will be missing for Panama.
I'm okay with that.
it's horrible. I don't know what to tell you.
Okay, so the Sounders were on international break this week because of these matches being played. And this weekend, they play FC Dallas.
They do. So there were some MLS matches played over the weekend, and let's discuss those a little bit because of the fact that... Actually, I'm sorry, Panama is in the World Cup. It's Honduras on goal differential that is in the Inter-Confederation playoffs.
I can't believe this happened.
It really is stunning. Also, the U.S., by the way, it is a point of how terrible, soccer, playing as few matches as they are is because of the fact that there's so much randomness in soccer. USMNT with the fourth best goal differential or third best goal differential and finishes fifth in their group. I bet by expected goals they came out well as well. So a couple of matches, as I said, that affected the Sounders over the weekend, and both of them went pretty well. Sporting Kansas City, which is still first place in the Western Conference, drew at Minnesota, and then Vancouver lost at the New York Red Bulls. Vancouver's in first place. They're 4 points up on the Sounders. Sporting KC, with the 1 point for the draw, moved 1 point up on the Sounders with one match in hand. They still have 3 matches remaining over the last 2 weeks of the season, whereas the Sounders have just the 2 matches.
Wow, down to 2 matches?
I know.
I never thought the time would come.
The interminable MLS regular season is nearly at its conclusion. So the Sounders still just a 25% chance of a first-round bye, and they pretty much have to win both remaining games if they're going to get one of those top two spots in the Western Conference and advance directly to the conference semifinals. FC Dallas comes into town battling for one of the last 2 playoff spots in the West, so a potential first-round matchup for the Sounders in that opening round. They've been awfully unlucky this year, but also not as good as last year when they finished first in the Western Conference in the regular season before a late-season injury contributed to them losing to the Sounders in the conference semifinals, their first playoff round. So, again, this is a game the Sounders have to get.
And it feels like they really, hopefully having these 2 weeks off will help them regroup. Soccer's insane. But,
well, not really regroup. Get healthy is the big thing. And we haven't heard an update on Jordan Morris. So that'll be interesting to see if he's able to get back before the end of the MLS regular season.
This is a team that desperately needs a win, though.
They only lost one match where they basically started very, 3 or 4 regulars.
But they haven't looked good for months.
No, they looked really good against Vancouver in their 3-0 domination of them.
Okay.
Just before the break.
One good-looking match in months.
Yes.
And they need to continue that.
I don't think they need to look good. I think they need to win. They need to get to 3 points.
Okay.
That's what they need to
do. Okay. You're going Seattle Seahawks, just get out of there with a victory. Doesn't matter what happens.
I'm going Oakland Raiders. Just win, baby. In Seattle Storm news, we discussed last week that they were, the AP report that they were going to hire Dan Hughes as their new head coach. That officially came to pass last Wednesday, just after this podcast came out. And he, made a bit of a media tour in the last week and had some interesting comments, I thought, on a podcast with Summit Hoops and then also Locked On WNBA, where he set the expectations pretty high. He was not afraid to talk about, the championship potential with this team if it improves defensively. And, kind of talked about the need for a more defensive mindset, highlighted small forward Alicia Clark as someone who's, defensive mentality I'd like to see other players emulate. And then I also thought it was interesting when talking to the Seattle Times, he credited part of his desire to come out of retirement to Styx's new album, The Mission.
What?
He was a longtime fan of Styx and a friend of one of the members. And, their new direction apparently in this most recent album, which I was unaware.
And which anyone was unaware.
Started
except for him, head coach Dan Hughes.
Made him think about it. He's a big music fan, noted for wearing his Jimi Hendrix tie when his team plays in Seattle. So now he's going to have to wear it every single
game. A lot of Jimi Hendrix tie.
Yeah. Gonna have to get a lot, 17 different ones for each game.
You're saying the Storm's new coach decided to come out of retirement because of a new album by the band Styx in the year 2017?
I mean, I don't think I'm gonna draw a one-to-one correlation between it, but it was a factor in him thinking about, like, you know, wanting to reinvent yourself and stay relevant.
Define relevant.
Stay current? I don't know.
Okay. Well, I was not expecting that.
Yeah, I know. I know you aren't. The other thing, so Dan Hughes was in town this week, and Brianna Stewart posted a photo on Twitter of the two of them talking, and notably, Dan Hughes rocking a Popovich Kerr 2020 t-shirt.
Oh, really?
He knows what's up.
Oh, man. Now I got to listen to the Styx album now. Because of his pop card t-shirt.
Should we talk about Husky football?
Absolutely.
So a 38-7 win Saturday versus California.
A dominating 38-7 win.
Yeah, a game where Cal should have... It's the second straight week that they should have had a shutout. The previous week, it was the second unit that let them down. This time, it was a fluky offensive turnover that, you know, a fumble that gets returned for a touchdown. That's the only way Cal scored, because offensively, they... If they played against UW's first team defense, they could have played several games and not scored. I think we made that same comment last week about Oregon State. 8 sacks in this game for the Huskies. Then on the final play, while Cal's attempting a field goal to get to cover the spread, most notably, they fumble the snap and lose 41 yards on that, therefore leaving them with negative rushing yardage on the day. They were at, I think they had gotten up to like 2 rushing yards before that play.
Wait, did they get negative 40 for that?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because it was considered a fumble, basically.
And that counts as negative rushing yardage?
I guess so.
College football's weird. That's what I
learned. It is very weird. But anyway, they spent most of the game with negative rushing yardage because, as we've complained about in the past, sacks count as rushing yards in college football.
But also, the defense dominated.
Yeah, I mean, as we said to each other during the game, this was some 1991 shit.
That's more of a you quote, but... Yes.
I guess you tweeted it afterwards.
Yes. I was just taking what you said and putting it on the internet.
Yeah, because you don't remember the 91 season as well as I do, as you were 6 at the time. but like, I have this vivid memory of going to a game as a child against, I think it was Kansas State. I should have looked this up to see whether it was actually true. I don't know if the box score for that game even exists anymore. But I have a vivid memory of like being so amazed that Kansas State had negative rushing yards because of their sacks. This was before Bill Snyder turned the program around.
Well, happening again against Cal. I mean, honestly, not a lot of takeaways from this game. I mean, some solid play on offense.
Well, but... there's one takeaway. Can we toast?
Okay.
Can we toast to Hunter Bryan?
Oh, he looks so good.
Our friend at Seahawks Scout, Mike, has been saying that he's the most underrated, I don't know, most underrated tight end or whatever. I think he's pretty properly rated at this point. People seem pretty in on the Hunter Bryan experience.
Hunter Bryan's excellent.
This is everything we hoped for and expected from him as a recruit.
The ball that he caught on the sideline in the first drive, the touchdown ripping it away, Golden Tate style.
Yeah, shout out to simultaneous possession.
I mean, Hunter Bryant looks very good, but I think the offense in general looks really solid.
Well, I mean, I think the rushing game looks solid. The passing game outside of Hunter Bryant, he kind of, you know, helped cover up for the fact that
Hunter Bryant's carrying the team.
This was not a very impressive performance from the UW wide receivers, and really is not. I mean, and this, it was a good Cal we talked about. Under Justin Wilcox, they've dramatically improved defensively. But this was not one to write home about for the UW passing attack, I would say, for Jake Browning.
When you can kind of see what Justin Wilcox is doing with that Cal program, and I think he's going to have them be, I think they're going to be a good school in a couple of years.
Yeah, if they get the offense to come around. They were 20, Browning threw 40 passes for 215 yards in this game, 5.4 yards per attempt. And so notably, you don't have the targets here on the college football box score, but Bryant had 9 catches for 121 yards. You take him out, the other receivers had 18 catches for a combined 94 yards.
Yeah, those Dante Pettis 10 catches for 48 yards not looking so great. I would like to see them, instead of just constantly throwing screens to Dante Pettis, setting up this hypothetical future trick play, I would like to see them get Dante Pettis downfield a little bit more.
I mean, they were moving the ball consistently. I don't want to be negative. Like, again, they scored enough points. They played well enough to win this game. But you didn't really see anything from Andre Bocelli, who came back and played limited snaps. Not a lot from Aaron Fuller and Quentin Pounds, who combined for 4 catches for 33 yards. 19 of the Huskies' 27 catches coming from Bryant and Pettis. So you're going to need more balance going forward. And here's the thing.
Yes.
I think they're going to be able to do that against the Arizona State defense.
Man. Okay. Just before we start talking specifically about Arizona State.
Okay.
This is a scary Pac-12 after dark game.
It 100% is, because the high scores that Arizona State tends to have, the fact that they've been wildly up and down, they lose at home to San Diego State, who's decent, but you should probably still be beating at home. But then they beat number 23 Oregon. That's 23 in the FPI, and then we're competitive at Stanford.
Arizona State is a scary team. Going into Arizona is always scary. We remember the first Pac-12 road game that UW played last year, where it took overtime to beat Arizona.
And so the Huskies haven't, since that game, really played a Pac-12 dark after dark game, even in the after dark games they've played.
Yes.
They've been
Pac-12. I was going to say, they've played Pac-12 after dark games.
They've played no shortage of them, but there hasn't been a stereotypical wild Pac-12 after dark game.
The hope is that, and I've said this constantly, of any coach who's going to have his team ready and not let the moment get out of control, Chris Peterson will just make sure that he has the better team and win the game.
Especially heading into a bye week, I think, you know, they should be focused from that standpoint. But, you know, Arizona State is a quality offensive team, and a team that, as we noted in tonight's trivia, so I'll give you a free answer.
Wow.
When I put this online, the last team to beat UW on the road is Arizona State.
Fine. So Arizona offensively against this UW defense.
Yeah, their quarterback Manny Wilkins has been really excellent this season. Even in their losses, he's been quite good. And only Justin Herbert of Oregon, who is now injured, is averaging more yards per attempt as a passer in the Pac-12 so far this season than Manny Wilkins, who also is a bit of a threat, dual threat as a runner. Now, the good news for the Huskies is they have the chance to make Arizona State one-dimensional, because their rushing game is not good. They're averaging 3.0 yards per carry, which ranks 11th in the Pac-12, ahead of only Cal. And we saw what the Huskies did to Cal's run game. Kalen Ballage, their starting running back, averages 4.1 yards per carry. DeMario Richard, who shares carries with him, averaging 3.3 yards per carry. Neither of those guys have been factors out of the backfield. The Huskies, who are allowing the fewest yards per carry in the Pac-12, should shut this group down.
I am honestly so fascinated to see what this Husky defense looks like against a team who wants to pass the ball and feels like they can.
Yeah, because as you've noted, teams have been really reluctant to test the Husky secondary.
Well, and they've played a lot of teams who are pretty bad at passing, and things are going to change a little bit from here going forward. But you look at Colorado, just did not want to pass against them. Oregon State couldn't do it. Cal doesn't really have an offense. I am very fascinated what it's going to be like with this still young Husky secondary, who we feel very confident in, going against a team who's capable of passing the ball. But we know that they're going to be in obvious passing situations because of this run defense.
And because of the fact that their defense is so leaky. So they only rate, I was surprised, they only rate 89th in the country in defensive FPI, the efficiency ratings as part of the ESPN FPI. I think part of that is they've faced a really good schedule of offenses so far this season, but they are allowing 5.8 yards per carry on the ground, which ranks 11th in the Pac-12. They're averaging allowing 8.0 yards per pass attempt, which ranks 11th in the Pac-12, ahead of only Oregon State. And the combination is a Pac-12 high 6.9 yards per play for opponents this season. I think, much like Oregon State, this is an opportunity for the Huskies to, as you mentioned, go deep, try to get a lot of interference calls and big completion.
Yeah, they're going to move the ball. I totally agree with you.
The other thing here, by the way, is as bad as Arizona State's defense, their special teams are that much worse. They rank 124th in the country in efficiency. And I need to go double check how many teams there are in the country, but I know the answer is not a whole lot more than 124. That's at least in the FCS, that is. No, FBS. I always get that wrong. There are, let's see here, 130.
Okay, so pretty close to the bottom.
Yep, that's about as bad as you can get in special teams. Here are the teams behind them. Wow, Oklahoma has the worst special teams. I guess there are some major teams. I was expecting this to all be small conference teams. Texas State, UMass, Georgia Southern, Oklahoma State, Georgia Tech, and Oklahoma. I don't know what they're doing on special teams.
The state of Oklahoma needs to focus on some special teams. Yeah,
figure it out. But they have missed Zane Gonzalez's kicking now that he's off to the NFL. And they have, here's an amazing stat, they have 16 total punt returns all year. I think Dante Pettis, like, averages more than 16 yards per punt return.
They have 16 total punt return yards
Yep.
for the year.
All year.
Wow. But this is the type of game, aside from the special teams, where it would be very nice to see these receivers getting involved, to see people who are not Hunter Bryant. We're going to see a heavy dose of both Myles Gaskin and LeVon Coleman, who should be able to break off 4, 5, 6 yards per carry in this game, maybe even more. And I want to see that open things up and actually see Quentin Pounds getting downfield, Dante Pettis getting downfield. I'd like to see some deep passes, Hunter Bryant up the seam. You know, this is the type of game where it would be very nice to get the wide receivers involved in the offense.
Do you know how many yards Dante Pettis is averaging per punt return? Don't look.
Oh,
my
God.
Looking?
I'm not looking.
It's 31.8.
Wait, really?
He's every punt return on average is twice as long as the total number of punt return yards that Arizona State has all
season. You said they have 16 punt return yards?
Yes.
They have less punt return yards than Vita Vea has for the year.
Which is not a blocked punt. That was
still,
like a technical punt
still,
return.
Those count as punt return yards. Yeah,
apparently
that would count for Arizona State.
Yeah, that would.
Vita
Vea
is out gaining their punt returns. Man.
What an amazing stat. The Huskies better really
take,
is
you
wild.
Remember the Seahawks a couple years ago really owned not giving up any punt return yards?
Yes.
The Huskies in this game better not give up any punt return yards to Arizona State.
Do we want to do chances of victory or anything else to say on this matchup?
I'm scared of the matchup.
Yeah, I am too. I have appropriate fear.
I think that this sets up as a game that is going to be very good for the Huskies. I think just systematically, I think they can get up early and then force Arizona State to pass the ball and can create turnovers. And I think it could get out of hand. But at the same time, if they have a couple of series where they don't score, Arizona State can score quickly. And maybe they'll test this UW secondary and maybe they'll hit some big plays. Maybe something will go wrong. And all of a sudden, this is a close game going into the fourth quarter. And we're going to have to kind of see the first time that the Huskies are really tested this year. But I just don't know if I necessarily see it happening in this one.
I see like a 49-35 type shootout where, you know, I don't think Arizona State is, you know, knocking on the door to win the game, but they're competitive throughout and both teams score a lot of points.
So what are you going percentage chances of victory?
So FPI says 86%, and in this case, my heart says way lower. My gut says way lower. I'm at like 75.
Oh, I was going to go 85%.
Interesting. Huh. Yeah, I guess you're not as fearful as we thought.
I'm always fearful, but just across the board, Huskies are a better team in every single thing they do.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
All right, do you have any grievances this week?
Do you have any grievances?
My grievance right now is the Huskies are 6-0, as we noted last week.
Oh, no. I've got a lot of grievances, but I can't say them.
They're eligible for a bowl game, and once upon a time, that actually was a really big deal to be eligible for a bowl game. They have won every single game this season by multiple touchdowns. Why doesn't it seem like Husky fans are having any fun this season? All I seem to experience is this angst of waiting for, you know, we're going to get screwed by the college football playoff. ESPN hates us. It's just all these other things as opposed to actually, there's too many late kickoffs, as opposed to actually enjoying the fact that this team is just crushing opponents is incredibly fun to watch. This is everything you would want in a football team. So why doesn't it feel like it?
You're way off. You're way off in every way. And the real question is...
I mean, look, the alternative is you could be watching the Seahawks. You know how painful it is to watch the Seahawks?
Oh, man.
I love, you know, Pete Carroll. We've talked about this. Pete Carroll's whole...
Toughen up.
Yeah.
But you die a little bit every single time you watch the Seahawks.
They shorten your life. The Huskies do not shorten your life at all. They extend your life. They give you an inner peace.
Do you want to know why the Huskies don't shorten your life?
Why is that?
And that is because margin of victory. The most important way we as modern football fans understand to judge whether a team is really good or not is because of margin of victory. You don't win close games against bad teams. Really good teams don't play close games.
Yes.
And that's why the Huskies should be getting more respect for having the number one margin of victory of any team in the entire country. That's the story. The story isn't who you play. The story is how bad you beat the teams. And that's what people should be talking about. When certain networks are having certain segments talking about how bad the teams that the Huskies play are, while the Huskies are up 38-0, the story shouldn't be they've played bad teams in the past. The story should be they've played bad teams and they've destroyed those bad teams. Because it's much worse to be playing bad teams and be playing close games. Oklahoma, who you're talking about, just lost to Iowa State. The Huskies won 38-7, not giving up an offensive score to Cal.
which is, as I mentioned to you before the game, the relative rankings of Iowa State and Oklahoma were eerily similar to Cal and UW.
This is what elite teams do, right? And also, we can look at the Huskies' future schedule and see that they're going to be playing good teams. And that's another story. The story is they have, I think, what's up to was 13th and maybe might even be up into the top 10 most difficult remaining schedule left in the entire country.
It is 9th, according to Football Power Index. Specifically, every single team the Huskies play from here on out is rated better than every, in FPI again, better than every single team they have played to date. Now, that's a bit of a technicality. Arizona State's 49th and Colorado's 50th, but then every single team they play after Arizona State, after the bye, is better than every single team they've played so far.
Now, that might be a reason to be concerned about these games, but also it means that when we're at the end of this, we're going to really know what this team is,
yes,
and we're not going to be saying they didn't play anybody. Yeah. So honestly, this is a tired story. It doesn't matter. What's more important is not about who they've played in the past. What's more important is who they're going to play in the future and how badly they've beaten the teams in the past.
All right, well, with that off our
chest. My other airing of grievances, why are they rushing Thomas Rawls? This is where I was going. Why is Thomas Rawls finishing that game? Out of nowhere, he runs one time for the entire game leading up, I think, into the fourth quarter. One carry.
I have less qualms with that. I actually think Thomas Rawls is quite good at finishing out the game. I have more qualms with why is Thomas Rawls playing on third down instead of J.D. McKissick.
Why is Thomas Rawls playing on third down? Do the Seahawks, I mean, the Seahawks obviously know what a third down back is. Why are they using Thomas Rawls in that situation?
I mean, look,
why was Eddie Lacy in those situations? What? J.D. McKissick should have been in on every single fucking third down in the entire game.
Why are Tanner McAvoy and Amara Darbo playing on so many third and
looks? Oh my god, Tanner McAvoy. Could he have a worse season?
He's having Jermaine Curse's 2016.
Chandler. Could he be any worse? It's like, okay, that's another thing. It's like the Seahawks don't even look at what the situation is with the personnel they have in the game. Because they have crucial situations where the receivers are Tanner McAvoy, Amara Darbo, Trey Madden is in the game on crucial third downs. It's like, this is something that no other team does. When you watch the Patriots and there's a crucial third down, they're not like, this is the moment when we have to work it. Wait, who's an obscure Patriots player?
Matt Devlin?
I guess so, yeah. They know you have your best players on the field in the most crucial situations, right? There was a third down where I swear to God they had a three-receiver set, and this was in the second half. Tanner McAvoy, Amara Darbo, and I think Baldwin.
Yeah, I think that happened. That sounds about right.
Why do you even have the receivers you have if you're not going to play them? I don't even think Jimmy Graham was on the field.
I mean, the receivers they had played a lot of snaps overall. It's just that they didn't necessarily play the highest leverage snaps.
You're looking for some obscure Patriots receivers?
His name is James Devlin. Matt Devlin is an NBA broadcaster.
It's like if they took special teams specialist Matthew Slater and he was in the game on a crucial third down.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a good one.
It's like, what are you doing? You should be using your personnel groupings based upon the situation, and the Seahawks are so bad at it.
You done?
a
lot of sighing in this podcast. All things considered.
No, it was fine overall because the Seahawks won the game, but there were so many things that they just have to tighten these things up. What is Tanner McAvoy doing on the roster?
I mean, Tanner McAvoy is useful on special teams, and I think he's...
Has he been useful on special... Also, I have another grievance. Why are the Seahawks bad at special teams now? When was the last time they even had
a pretty good game on special teams on Sunday?
I saw them being out... I mean, granted, the Rams are very good on special teams, and Greg Zuerlein missed a field goal, but like, Johnny Hecker, come on.
Oh,
these punts are unbelievable.
You can't compare other people to Johnny Hecker. Johnny Hecker is practically robo-punter. You think that's a joke, but it's not. The Seahawks were plus 9.5 points on special teams relative to the EPA, relative to the Rams on Sunday.
Yeah, but look how much worse they were in all these previous games.
Yeah, we've already complained about that. They've turned the corner.
They've turned the corner in a lot of ways.
This is their best special team performance of the season.
All right, good for them.
All right, let's get to the Seahawks. All right, well, now we would like to welcome into the podcast to help us talk about the Seahawks. We're thrilled to be joined by ESPN's new Seahawks reporter, Brady Henderson. How's it going?
Hey, guys. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Kind of wanted to start by talking about last Sunday's win over the Rams, and then go from there into a discussion about, you know, kind of the season as a whole as the Seahawks head into the bye week here at 3-2. Starting in LA, what do you think we learned about the Seahawks with their performance against the Rams in that victory?
Yeah, that was an interesting game. I think from offensively, I don't think it was just the overall performance was a terrible surprise, just because that's kind of how we've seen games against the Rams go. It's a really bad matchup. Right. Seattle up front with their offensive line and the Rams defensive line. So, you know, that kind of went according to how you thought, you figured it was going to be a slog for them offensively. And defensively, it was kind of, it was, I thought it was remarkable how they recovered after that slow start. 124 yards against the Seahawks defense in the first quarter. And it seemed like they just did not have, you know, very many answers for Jared Goff and Todd Gurley. And, you know, they had the Tavon Austin touchdown run, which kind of we've seen the Seahawks defense get gassed a little bit against the run this year. And then to turn it around like they did with three takeaways in the second half, you know, for whatever reason, the saying is that turnovers come in bunches. And we haven't seen a ton of them this year, but they came in bunches in the second half. And it was really, I thought the pass rush that had been really kind of inconsistent this year came alive on a couple of those plays, and those turnovers were the difference. And, you know, let's be honest, as even a lot of players said, there was some good fortune involved there at the end when Cooper Kupp dropped that. I don't know if you can call it a drop, but he did not catch that that pass in the end zone that he got two hands on. So just a wild game, as a lot of those Rams games have been. And the Seahawks were fortunate to come out on the winning end this time, but their defense in the second half of that game.
An archetypal Seahawks-Rams game on the road, especially. But I think for the defense, on that first drive, we were watching the game thinking to ourselves, maybe this defense just isn't good. They come out and kind of march down the field. Then they get the Earl turnover, and things start looking a little bit different, but I think we're still pretty tentative. And by the end, it was kind of the culmination of what Pete Carroll keeps saying, where it's going to come, it's going to come, be patient, it's going to come. And all of a sudden, in the second half, the Seahawks look like the dominant defensive team with pressure, forcing turnovers, doing everything that we've seen them do in the past. They kind of look like the defense that we've seen before. And think about it in terms of the games that they played previously in the season, especially on the road, where the defense wore down immensely in the second halves of those games against Green Bay and Tennessee. And in this one, actually got stronger as the game went on.
Yeah. And you mentioned, that opening series. I think we talked to Sheldon Richardson after the game, and one of the things he was saying was that, the Rams threw a lot of things at them that they had not seen on film. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that this was a new team that the Seahawks were facing. This was not these are not the Jeff Fisher Rams. This is a remade, reinvented offense under Sean McVay. And I think there was just, it took a little time for them to feel them out. Sheldon Richardson said there was a play where he got trapped and he hadn't seen a trap, you know, from them on film. It was kind of curious. You saw some receivers running wide open in the secondary. There was, as I mentioned, not a ton of pressure on Jared Goff. And I just wonder how much of that was just having to feel out what for them was pretty much a brand new opponent, at least offensively.
Yeah, and then I guess the other interesting question that's raised here is, this is a new Rams offense and one that's performing way better than anyone expected going into the season. Yeah. So how much of what we saw in the second half was the Seahawks defense stepping up as opposed to the Rams regressing to the mean?
Yeah, I was thinking during that game, you know, as much as they were relying on Jared Goff, and as much as Goff's kind of wanting to put that game in Goff's hands as opposed to, to Gurley, it kind of felt like, as good as this defense is, didn't you just feel like it was only a matter of time before they forced Goff into the mistake? And they did. You saw that with the interception that he threw. He floated that pass right to Earl Thomas on that play. Jaron Reed, and I think it was Harrison Smith as well, both got pretty good push, and they really collapsed the pocket. Jared Goff could not see that pass. I think that's why that pass floated the way it did. And then the play by Frank Clark to blow by Andrew Whitworth, who's been one of the best left tackles in the NFL over the last few seasons, this season especially. He said that he had really set that move up, and he'd been trying to set that move up all game, and it finally worked for him. So you figure that this defense was too good not to be forcing turnovers. They had the big one last week, actually a couple last week. But this was the game when it really kind of exploded on them, and that was the difference in half, or it helped as far as the difference in half, because they still had to survive that last drive.
I love the Frank Clark thing about setting it up all game, where it's like, I like to imagine all the things that people set up all game that never came to fruition. It's like, yeah, every exactly game, right, everybody is setting something up all game, and then it never works. Frank Clark finally got one, so he gets to gloat about how he'd been setting it up all game.
Yeah, it was very well timed, and it did not look like a terribly sophisticated move. I went back and watched it. It was a speed move to the end. He kind of gave him a little bit of a duck underneath with the hand. So that's something to follow up on with Clark. What exactly was that move? But whatever it was, it worked for him, and he really blew by one of the NFL's best left tackles for a huge play in that game.
Yeah, who had, I believe, only allowed one pressure all season before giving up that sack, Andrew Whitworth.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to interrupt there, but our ESPN guy who covers the Rams said that, I think, via the analytics department, I think it was only 8 times that Goff had been hit all season over the first 4 games. So that was, that's kind of what we had seen in the first quarter, or in the first half of that game, at least. There was not a ton of pressure, and I think on one of the times when they did pressure and they had to bring 6 defenders, and that was the play where, I think it was the 3rd down play, Goff ended up scrambling for 22 yards just because there was 4 defenders who were back there to stop him. So it was a lot of open room for him. So it took a while for them to get after him, but when they did, they made it count.
Yes, the Goff scramble was such a frustrating play.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that was what a lot of defenses feel every time Russell Wilson does that. It's backbreaking when you get to a quarterback and you feel like you should have a sack, and then all of a sudden it goes from a 10-yard loss to a 20-yard gain for the offense. I think Russell Wilson's done that to a lot of teams, and Jared Goff did it to him on Sunday.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I think, you going back to something you said earlier, like, you wonder how much differently we would all feel about the Seahawks if Cooper Kupp does haul in that pass in the end zone, if Goff maybe leads him a little bit less, and then all of a sudden, it's still not a bad performance on the road by the Seahawks against what is looking like a much more promising Rams team. But now the Seahawks are, I'm trying to do this math in my head, they'd be 2 games back in the division and no better than have the tiebreaker in terms of the season series, as opposed to now being tied with the Rams in the standing and being guaranteed of at least splitting the season series, makes them, as you wrote about today, using ESPN's Football Power Index, really in the driver's seat in the NFC West.
Yeah, and they've got the home game against the Rams, and the Seahawks really seem to be in control here. With the bye coming up, they've got 2, there's no gimme. I would never say gimme in the NFL. There's no gimme opponents, but those are 2 pretty favorable matchups just because of how things have gone for the Giants. They're 0-5. They're, every single receiver on their roster, it seems like, is hurt. And then the Houston Texans is going to be another matchup for them, another bad matchup for Seattle in the way that the Rams matchups always seem to be, just because of that defensive front. Well, that matchup looks a lot easier now that J.J. Watt is out and Merciless are out. So, the Seahawks have to feel pretty good about themselves. There's a ton of work to do, and they've got some injury concerns themselves. But, just going into the bye week, winning a game like that against what has looked like the stiffest competition for them in the division, that's got to be a pretty good feeling.
Before we transition into the future just yet, I want to talk Seahawks offense for a second. And we were talking about the defense not wearing down in the second half, but also the Seahawks on offense continuing to try to run the ball as best as they can. Do you think there is anything to the idea that they weren't dominated in time of possession, especially in the first half of this game, in the way that they might have been in a couple of the previous games that they played?
Yeah. And that was the issue, I think, one of the big issues with the running game this year, and why they it's been a matter of attempts, and it's been, kind of a product of the way some of the games have gone. In Green Bay, it was, there were so many negative plays on early downs just because their offensive line had such a hard time up front, and there were so many negative plays on early downs that really forced them into passing. And then a couple weeks later in Tennessee, they fell down. I think at one point they were down by 16 points in the second half, and you're kind of forced to, you really don't have time to to kind of try to establish the running game like that. And so I think it's more been, part of it has been a product of in that game, it wasn't really a matter of time and possession. There was never, I think they were down 10-0, but that was in the second quarter. It just wasn't happening for them. There was a lot of times where Aaron Donald and Michael Brockers were in the backfield. I looked at every running play by Eddie Lacy and Thomas Rawls, and there was a handful of negative running plays that just didn't seem to have any chance. So it seems like it's been pretty inconsistent. It was a high note, the high water mark for that running game against Indianapolis, 194 yards, and a lot of that was because the offensive line, I went back and looked at the numbers from ESPN. I think it was like 130 of the 194 yards were picked up before contact, which just, you know, kind of, it's a pretty good indication of good run blocking. So it's just been pretty inconsistent. But I think, again, it goes back to the fact that this is a tough matchup for them up front. It's kind of figured that they were going to have their hands full with the Rams defensive line.
I mean, this has been an ongoing debate, it seems like, or discussion, you know, probably since 2015. But, you know, do you feel like, following Pete Carroll as closely as you do, that at any point he and Daryl Bevel and Tom Cable would start to lean a little bit less on the run, and in particular maybe a little bit less on the more traditional I-form running that, you know, seems to be Eddie Lacy and to a lesser extent Thomas Rawls' their forte, and maybe just go more to spread it out with J.D. McKissic and C.J. Procise, and, you know, try to rely on those guys as both receivers and rushers?
Yeah. And, you know, it seems like a long time ago that Michael Robinson was lead blocking for Marshawn Lynch on a few plays. We just, you know, I think Trey Madden is, what, you know, maybe 10 snaps a game or something like that, if that. So it is kind of a different era of the Seahawks running games. Don't see the fullback used as much. No, and I thought you mentioned J.D. McKissic. That's an interesting guy because he has been, over the last couple games, you know, to varying degrees, kind of what they had hoped C.J. Procise would be. You know, he had the two long touchdowns against Indianapolis, and then I think it was three catches on Sunday. One of them was a 21-yarder that set up. It was a big play on one of their scoring drives to get them to midfield. It's just been a kind of a different scene for the running game as far as the fullback, and maybe that had something to do with Marshawn Lynch and his preferences or his style. I whatever the case may be, it's had a very different look to it, and also, you know, along the same lines, it's not as many read option plays. So it's a very different running game than what we've seen, both in effectiveness and style.
Yes. I get so excited every time J.D. McKissic is on the field, just because of the element that he adds.
Wait, are you sure it's J.D. McKissic or is it Eddie Lacy?
It's always tough. But, I mean, he had two carries for 0 yards, but the fact that he has the three catches for 36 yards and is able to, on a 3rd and 3, 3rd and 4, be able to split out wide and pick up those first downs. I'm curious to see what his personal DVOA is going to be after this game, because I feel like he was making plays to pick up first downs. And you see somebody like Rawls finishing the game, and it's kind of like, what are we doing here, right? I mean, couldn't basically anybody just run into the line? Like, what is happening with Rawls? Why did he get those carries at the end of the game?
Yeah, well, you mentioned McKissic, and just one last point on that. I mean, Carroll was asked about him afterwards, and he had kind of a what seemed to me like a fairly tepid assessment of the way he played. I wondered if one of the things that one of the issues Carroll had was I think it was a third down play. It was on a sack early in the game where he kind of, it seemed like, whiffed on Robert Quinn, ended up being a sack. That's one of the big jobs of that kind of third down role, is helping out in pass protection, and maybe that's one area.
I'd like to hear his reviews of every single offensive lineman.
Yeah,
there.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
So the other thing that I feel like we saw a little bit more of in this game was Jimmy Graham split out wide, playing a little bit less tight end and looking a little bit more kind of like a wide receiver in this game.
Yeah. And I had seen a number from Pro Football Focus that kind of charted, you know, his, where he had lined up over the first four games. And it was interesting to see how much he's been split out wide this season. And, you know, I think one of the things I'm writing about for tomorrow is, you know, that was the first, I cannot recall over his first two seasons ever seeing a successful fade pass to Jimmy Graham in the end zone. And it's really been one of the more mystifying things about, you know, the two plus seasons he's been here. I think you figured that he was not going to put up the same numbers that he did in New Orleans, just going from a pass-first offense to a more balanced offense. But it's really been a mystery as to why he hasn't been more of a factor in the red zone, and especially, you know, right down there near the goal line. And that was the first time that we had seen it. And frankly, it looked, you know, I don't want to say it looked easy, but it just makes you wonder, where has that been? You know,
it was everything we hoped and dreamed it would be, I guess, is how I would put it.
Yeah, two and a half years later, that was the first one. And I go back to, I think it was the offseason right after they traded for him in 2015. There were practices where that would just be play after play after play. It was Jimmy Graham, a lob to Jimmy Graham in the end zone against just an overmatched defensive back. He would catch it and spike it. The defense would get all riled up. And we saw that, I think, in one practice, like 3 or 4 times in a row. And it just made you think, like, that's going to be a staple of their offense. And then it, you know, surprisingly, 2+ seasons later, that was really the first time that we.
All right, well, let's shift to maybe talking more about the passing game. How would you kind of evaluate Russell Wilson over the first 5 weeks of this season and his performance?
Yeah, you know, he said something a couple weeks ago that I thought he made a good point, which is that, you know, they weren't that far off. You know, for all the issues that they've had on offense and pass protection, and I guess, you know, if we're talking specifically about their passing game, you know, they had been pretty close to a number of plays, and it was, you know, Russell Wilson overthrowing Tyler Lockett in the Green Bay game, Jimmy Graham dropping that third down pass in the fourth, I think it was the fourth quarter of that Green Bay game. There was a number of, I mean, all the drops they had in the San Francisco game. There was a number of plays like that where, you know, as ineffective as they looked as an offense as a whole, you know, you really have to figure, like, if they just make relatively simple plays, it would look a whole lot different. And, you know, Russell, like I mentioned, he's missed a few throws. I think he's been a lot sharper over the last couple of weeks now that, you know, that interception that he threw notwithstanding. I think that was a play where he just didn't think the safety could get over in time. It was kind of a floater of a pass to Luke Wilson. But, you know, I think it's been challenged a lot with just the way the offensive line is not really held up in pass protection. I think that's why you saw them have to move the pocket quite a bit on a lot of designed rollouts just to give him a chance, to, you know, because otherwise he's just a sitting duck, or he would have been just a sitting duck behind that offensive line in Sunday against the Rams. But, you know, there's just been a number of plays where it's not, you know, it doesn't seem like it's a huge fix. It's just making plays that you would expect NFL players to.
Do you put a lot of stock in the theory that there is an issue with Wilson's timing on grass? Another game where, you know, we didn't see him complete a lot of deep balls against LA was a little bit more efficient, I would say, in the intermediate range than, you know, perhaps at times in the first couple of losses on the road. But still definitely a difference between that Seahawks passing offense on grass and at home, in particular on turf.
Yeah, I've seen that, and Carroll, you know, Pete Carroll was asked about that. I guess he, not so much specifically the offense, but just kind of the team's record in the last 7 games on grass, and he seemed to have never even been aware of that there was any sort of trend there like that. I just tend to think that more coincidence than anything, just because, you know, when you look at 3 of those games, 2 of them have been against Packers at Lambeau Field, which is going to be, you know, a tough matchup no matter where you play them, because they're a really good team. And then, you know, one of those games, or I guess now 2 of those games, have been against the Rams at the Coliseum, and that's just, as we've talked about, that's just another tough matchup. So, you know, maybe there is something to it with the speed and just, you know, being used to playing on a different surface, but I just think that those would be tough matchups no matter, you know, no matter where they were playing or what surface they were playing.
We've sort of talked around the offensive line but not gotten specifically into it. How much improvement have you seen, and how much more improvement do you think we can expect over the course of the season? And then factoring in, Luke Jokel sounds like probably going to at least miss the New York game after undergoing surgery during the bye week. So you are going to have see some sort of hit in terms of the continuity of the offensive line with Mark Lewinsky presumably stepping in for him there.
Yeah, and I thought that they had made progress since the opener. Now, then again, it was a pretty low bar because I think it was, you know, it was 40-something% of his dropbacks that Wilson was pressured on in that game. And that was just, you know, we've seen some pretty tough performances, some pretty poor performances in pass protection over the last few years. And that was, I don't know if I've seen a game where they were more challenged than they were in that one. It seems like it has gotten better, and I think they would point to Ode Abushi taking Mark Lewinsky at right guard is kind of a, you know, a bit of a stabilizing presence there. I think he's been better in pass protection, and he's also, as you know, Pete Carroll and Tom Cable have mentioned every chance they've had, that he's really improved the communication, and he's kind of helped out Jermaine Ifedi, which I think is a big deal when you talk about, you know, a second-year player who's really starting at right tackle for the first season because he was playing guard last year. And you can see why that would make a sort of veteran presence in there would help out a young guy like that. And as you mentioned, it is going to be difficult, and it remains to be seen what exactly they're going to do. I think the logical move would be to put Mark Lewinsky at left guard just because he started 16 games there last year. But you know, they've also got Ethan Posick on the bench. And, you know, you kind of figured by now, it's been interesting. You know, Ethan Posick was a second-round pick, and you figured that, you know, playing in the SEC, that that might be a kind of a ready-made NFL starter. Maybe not right away, but there's been opportunities for him to enter the starting lineup. And, George Fant going down at left tackle. Glowinski struggling over the first few games at guard, and now and we've seen them make other moves there. So it kind of makes you wonder, you know, if Ethan Posick was as ready made as it seemed like he would be, you know, why hasn't he found the field yet? And we'll see what they do. I think it'll be either Mark Glowinski or Ethan Posick taking over for Joakim, and we'll see what they do there. But that'll be an interesting decision.
Maybe now that they have 2 weeks, they might be able to feel like they can get Posick comfortable at a new position. But where do you stand on kind of the rumors that have happened in the last couple of days? How much fire is there around Brandon Albert, who came in for a visit this week and left without a contract offer, and Dwayne Brown from Houston, who's still holding out?
Yeah, those are two interesting ones. I mean, I guess it's not surprising in the sense that we know the Seahawks are going to kick every tire, they're going to turn over every rock and whatnot. But it seems like, you know, bringing a guy in for a visit, and that seems like there's a, you know, that indicates a certain level of seriousness in Brandon Albert. You know, they like players who are all in, and a guy who retires, you know, right before the start of training camp doesn't necessarily scream all in. But, you know, maybe there's a level of desperation there. I had seen the Albert news yesterday that ESPN had reported, and I asked Carroll what he thought of the way Reese Odhiambo played yesterday, and he was, you know, fairly complimentary. That is kind of what Carroll does. He's not going to rip a guy in public by any means, you know, as far as the way the guy plays. But I found that interesting. And then as far as Dwayne Brown goes, I don't know what to make of that one. And I don't know if what was, you know, the source of that speculation. I don't know if that itself was pure speculation or if it was reporting. It's kind of hard to distinguish between the two. But, you know, I guess the major hangup I see there is, you know, if the guy's already making $9+ million, you know, that alone would be hard enough for the Seahawks to fit under their salary cap. But, you know, he's holding out because he feels like he deserves more money. And I don't think you see very often, you know, what's to say that he would be any more willing to play for that money for the Seahawks as opposed to playing, you know, at that price for the Texans. So you got to figure it's going to cost at least the prorated amount of whatever he was already making. And if he's holding out, he's going to want more. Plus, it's going to cost a draft pick. Plus, you know, he's a 32-year-old player at this point. So you probably figure that he's on the decline and he's been out for the first month plus of the season. So, you know, people are holding, you know, if people have really high hopes that Dwayne Brown is going to be the savior, I just don't know how realistic that is. And I don't even know how realistic it is that there's, you know, anything brewing there in the first
place. Yeah, and I think you said it with all of those different things. If it was one of those factors, I could see it. But the combination of the money, where they'll probably have to restructure somebody, which they already did with Sheldon Richardson, the pick, which they've already traded the second round pick for Sheldon Richardson, or the fact that you might have to sign a 32-year-old to an extension, which, given their unwillingness to sign offensive linemen aside who are not named Justin Britt to long-term extensions, I don't see why somebody who you've really never seen before you would be willing to commit to an extension to and be willing to give up those other two, be willing to give up the draft pick and the flexibility in the future.
Yeah. And the point that you made about having to restructure, you know, a contract already to fit Sheldon Richardson in there, that's not something that the Seahawks want to do. And John Schneider has been on the record about that, saying that they do not like to treat, you know, player contracts kind of like credit cards, which, you know, a lot of other teams are willing to do that. The Dallas Cowboys are kind of famous for doing that, and other teams. And the Seahawks have already done it once, and it's hard to imagine that John Schneider would be all that thrilled about having to do it again. So it's just, like you said, it's a lot of things in there that seem to be working against it. And I don't even know. I think everybody was reacting to, unless I missed something, I think everybody was reacting to one kind of tweet from a radio host. And I don't know if that was rooted in reporting or in speculation in the first place, what he tweeted. It just seems like, I just don't know how realistic it is. I'm sure that the Seahawks have acquired, that they've looked, because that's what they do. But I just don't know how realistic it is. And you can feel free to throw that back in my face when, you know, out in a few days that they pulled off a trade for Dwayne Brown. But as of right now, it's just kind of hard to see.
Well, perhaps the Seahawks front office did hear my theory on last week's Taste Profanity podcast about why you should no longer play for the future and should only be concerned about winning now. But that does seem at odds with the win forever philosophy. To wrap things up, Seahawks go into the bye week at 3-2, and we know that, you know, even though they've been tested on the road, the more difficult part of the schedule statistically still lies ahead. Going into last week, Football Outsiders rated their past schedule 30th in the NFL and their future schedule 12th in the NFL. Now, that was, of course, before the various Giants wide receiver injuries and the J.J. Watt and Whitney Merciless injuries in Houston you mentioned earlier. But, you know, where do you see this team finishing based on what we've seen in the first 5 weeks and what we know about the schedule going forward?
Yeah, well, they've got some tough games there. The Atlanta game, which I believe is on a Monday night, Philadelphia game. Philadelphia's 4-1. I think they played them on a Sunday night, and then Dallas on Christmas Eve. So it's not, you know, I think the combined record of their opponents is, you know, 6 games under .500. But it's I don't think you can say that that's an easy schedule by any means. Even though 6 of those games are at home, so that's a benefit to them. But you know, I guess regardless of the opponent, this is just, you know, we've seen the Seahawks, especially on offense, we've just seen them, you know, really improve a lot in the second halves of seasons. And Mike Sando had an interesting column about this the other day, kind of theorizing that, you know, one of the reasons for that may be because there's typically so many moving parts on the offense early in the season, especially on the offensive line. We see them, you know, switch out starters, you know, in the season, during training camp, you know, midway through the preseason. And that may be part of the reason why the offenses tend to start slow in the second half of the season and then get better, they start slow and then get better in the second half, is just because all those moving parts on the offense start to settle in. I wouldn't be surprised if the offense really is a lot better in the second half of the season than the first half. The offensive line is going to be, you know, an issue, especially if Luke Joko has to miss any more than one game. But I just, you know, we've seen this offense really kind of take flight in the second halves of season. That's one reason to be encouraged.
I'd say I'm feeling pretty good about the Seahawks' chances in the NFC West, going back to, you know, the article you wrote today about their dominant position in FPI, which had the Rams rated much lower going into the season than Football Outsiders' DVOA, which had the Rams favored going into last week to win the NFC West. I would say that the concern that's really developing here is this going to be another one of those seasons like last year? You know, the Seahawks were in position at that before the Arizona loss to get one of the top two seeds in the NFC, get a bye, get home field in the second round. They lost that opportunity. But this year, you look at Green Bay already having the tiebreaker, the strength of the NFC South with both Atlanta and Carolina at the top. The Seahawks will have an opportunity to play Carolina, and then Philly starting 4-1. Are the Seahawks going to be able to work themselves back in position to get one of those top two seeds and have a clearer path to the NFC Championship game?
Yeah, that's the big question for them, and that's kind of been the different, you know, the two times that they've made the Super Bowl, it was both, you know, as a top seed.
Three times,
that's true, going back to 2005 as well, yeah, as the top seed and not having to go on the road in the playoffs, and, you know, that bye is going to be, that would be especially important for them, not just because it's an automatic, you automatically move on, but just because their actual bye this season is relatively early, probably earlier than most teams would prefer. And so there's going to be, if I can try to do math on the fly here, there's going to be 11 straight weeks that they're playing. And so that bye, that first round bye, would be a pretty big deal for them. And it just, it makes those Atlanta game, the games against Atlanta, the game against Philadelphia, and potentially that game against Dallas as well, all the more important, just because that could be the difference as far as the tiebreaker goes.
All right, well, to wrap things up, a little bit lighter question. So many great personalities on this Seahawks team. Who's the most enjoyable interview in that locker room for you?
Gosh, you know, I actually was just listening to my old station, 710 ESPN Seattle, where I came from, and they had Luke Wilson on the show, and I think he was talking about something about why he something about dogs, or maybe it was another conspiracy theory that he has. Luke is one of the more entertaining guys on the team, so he's the guy that comes to mind. You know, Richard Sherman, I think, is you know, a very enjoyable guy to interview. It's, you know, his kind of relationship with the media hit a little bit of a rough patch last year, but it has been, you know, entirely back to what it had always been before that. And so those are two of the guys that come to mind right off the bat. Luke Wilson is just a legitimately funny guy.
Nice. It's interesting you mentioned Richard Sherman, because there's so many stories, the media, Richard Sherman, and now it hasn't been a conversation at all this season. I feel like we haven't seen it one time, really. And it's kind of amazing how quickly he's kind of returned to where he was and maybe just needed the off season to get over that.
Yeah. It seems like just there's been the term that comes to mind is just a reset button, just because this is exactly how it was, or it seemed like, you know, just for, you know, up until the second half of last season, when there was those sideline episodes and all the fallout from that. It just seems like it's everything is kind of back to the way that it was before that.
How would you describe Earl Thomas after having the season-ending injury last year? How his attitude has been towards the media, kind of in general at practice? How would you describe him this season?
Yeah, I can't believe I got this far without talking about Earl, because he was fantastic on Sunday. You know, not only with the play he made near the goal line, which is a play we've seen him make a few times now, and the interception, but he was just all over the field. And the one thing that stands out to me about his play is he just does not seem the least bit hesitant. And the reason why I say that stands out is because I remember a couple of years ago when he suffered that, I think it was that he tore up his shoulder in the NFC Championship game against the Packers. He came back the next season, I think after having surgery on it, and he talked about, you know, in sort of retrospect, talked about how he was hesitant and he was not playing as fast as he was. And it wasn't a matter of having lost a step physically. It was just that he was not trusting himself. He was just playing tentative. And really from the first preseason game this year, it has been very evident that he is just back to the Earl Thomas who flying around and who sees things seemingly, you know, a tick before everybody else does, anticipating things. And he just seems to be playing at the level in every single way, at the level that had kind of become accustomed to the Earl Thomas playing. And I think you can see as a result that, you know, there was that kind of that anomaly in the Tennessee game where they allowed a few big plays. But for the most part, you know, their defense has been a lot better than it was, especially, you know, once he went down last year, that passing defense really fell apart. And we've seen them just kind of be more like what you'd expect them to be now that Earl Thomas is back.
Yeah, the Rams had that one ball on the last series of the game that they got just over Cam Chancellor's fingertips. But otherwise, any time Jared Goff was looking deep, felt pretty confident that somebody was going to be there and they were going to be well covered.
Yeah, and that was just a mistimed jump, I think, by Cam Chancellor. Now, you know, Earl kind of took the blame for Cooper Kupp getting open on that third down pass. Earl said that he had kind of anticipated, he thought that Goff might like a matchup on the other side of the field, and he didn't say this, but I think he was talking about whoever Shaquille Griffin was covering, because that was kind of the route that Earl started going towards, thinking that Goff was going to, and I think he said he even tried to bait Goff into that throw, and Goff kind of looked him off, and by the time that, you know, Earl kind of crossed, you know, the sort of the middle part of the field, it was too late, and Goff went back to the Cooper Kupp. And Earl was frank about it. He said, look, I feel lucky. I got lucky there. But I guess he and the defense, you know, they were lucky there, but they were pretty good. Earl Thomas and the Seahawks defense in general was very good.
Well, I mean, always happy and always lucky to get out of L.A. with a victory and position themselves in a pretty good place, as you wrote today on ESPN, to kind of control the NFC West from here going forward. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brady. Where can people find your work?
Just on the Seahawks Clubhouse page on ESPN.com, and then also on Twitter, at Brady Henderson. Keeping it simple, at Brady Henderson.
Yeah, if you're not following him, you absolutely should be. And then while you're at the ESPN Seahawks Clubhouse, if after that you want to navigate over to the NBA page, that would be great too.
There you go.
Nobody has insider.
Thanks again, Brady.
Thanks.